You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Sean Parker. Sean is a wonderful actor and writer. We were classmates at Juilliard, and he's one of my favorite artists to be on stage with, and a person it gives me so much joy to call my good friend. His honesty, generosity, and open-heartedness are always apparent in his work, and I was very glad he was willing to share his story with me here for the podcast. Sean lives in LA now, and I really miss having these heart-to-hearts with him in person. This was recorded over the phone. I hope you enjoy the 39th episode of The Compass. So, Sean, what is the dark side for you, and how do you try to avoid going there? I know it's really not fair for me to ask that question first, but I just...
No, I love that you asked it first. I really do.
Go big or go
home.
And
I knew that it was coming from having heard, your start of other episodes. I guess I would say, the dark side is... So your question is a twofold. So what is the dark side to me? I'll tackle that first.
Okay. Starting, I'm realizing I'm apartment sitting by JFK, so I'm realizing how loud the planes are when they go overhead. So if you hear a rumbling noise, it's a plane.
Oh, so likewise, if you hear a helicopter,
sorry,
it's probably someone going over me.
Okay.
But I don't hear anything, so it's fine.
Okay.
I think the dark side is it's everything. So, like many others, I'm sure it's like a very multifaceted thing. It has to do with, of course, rejection plays a part of it. Finances definitely play a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Self-doubt, self-image, self-worth, all that kind of, how you, if you're not, quote-unquote, succeeding as an artist in the way that you want to, then, just all those identity questions, because you were so long sort of invested in that, idea. So that's, of course, all a part of it. But I think with time, I won't say that that's lessened, because it's still, when I still get a rejection or something, it's still definitely a blow. But it's the way that it registers now. It's maybe not so immediate, or I can read a letter saying I didn't get into a fellowship or something, and I don't notice an immediate visceral response in my body, which is a sign, I think, of, I don't know what, but I think that it's sort of like a chain reaction, I think. So, you can, store up a lot of rejection and self-doubt and stuff, and then it surfaces later at times. But for me, the dark place for me mostly has to do with the work itself and not any of the industry stuff, because it all comes down to they all have the same guiding principle, all of these dark places, and I think it comes down to lack of control or feeling powerless.
Yeah.
And the thing is with work, I don't mind it so much because with industry, you always know it's going to be powerless. And I'm sure this will come up later in the talk, but, it's commerce, And I think the longer you're in it, the more you realize, they used to tell us acting is a business,
mm-hmm.
In fourth year and to start to gauge that. But really what I think they're saying is acting is money, or you could go one step further. Because business, I think, almost sounds too clean.
Huh.
Storytelling, it's money. When you're looking at it for a career, not for purposes of, being at home or family or anything like that. I was saying with industry, I think you can, the longer, it just comes in waves. Some days it really doesn't bother me at all because I'm just, you're more attuned to it, or, you've gone through that initial wave of rejection, and and you're just like, all right, you know, I'll find the industry as it finds me, that sort of thing, you know. But when the dark place is still really difficult is with work, and particularly the example I'll give is with writing of late, or not of late, but just in general. Like, so I wrote a play last summer. And I guess, and then I had a reading of it. So I wrote it, I finished in September. But it had been a long gestating work. So I would say, all told, there's maybe like 1,000 hours in, you know. And then you deliver it, you know, you share it for, because I had a reading when I was in New York, really casual, just with friends and stuff, at school, which was great that we could use a space there.
Right.
And it was about 2 hours and 40 minutes of a three-act play. So, let's say you work 1,000 hours, then you do a reading for like 2.5 hours, and then you have a 20-minute talkback session. And then you go home and reflect on all this, you know, so it's very skewed in terms of, like, how much, just purely from time, how much you have to invest to create something with the scope that you're imagining, and then to receive such, I guess, like, a limited time frame of feedback, start to realize, oh, no, like, there are all these parts of this that didn't come across the way I had imagined.
Right.
And so I think ultimately the dark place is like feeling sort of betrayed by your own impulses, like particularly with writing and also in acting. And we know this from class so much, where we would be in a scene and we'd be like, wow, that felt amazing. You know, maybe you wouldn't say that, but you'd just be like, wow, like I was so in that, you know, and then of course you'd find out, or like you'd be stopped or something, or one of the teachers afterward would, you know, like illuminate the fact that, you know, you weren't actually listening at all, you know, and you're like, what, you know. It's sort of a similar principle with writing, where it can feel so thrilling when you're hooked in, and let's say, you know, you've been working for hours straight, and it's really flowing, and then you go back to it maybe days, weeks later, and you just think, like, wow, like, I don't doubt the place it was coming from, but really the feeling is, again, you just constantly learning that you can't rely on, like, the feeling of the process.
I think that's
the worst sort of feeling, because then you don't know how to sort of trust your own process.
That thing, like, what was that word that I feel like Becky always used at school, of, like, your barometer? You can't trust your barometer. Yeah, because something will feel so in touch, and then you realize that you totally left out a whole perspective or something.
A whole thing, yeah. Exactly.
That is hard. Yeah, I totally know what you mean. And especially with spending that, something with writing like that, where it's so intensive and so many hours, that must be really frustrating.
Yeah, and how it loops back to, like, again, the industry stuff and applying for things is, like, you start to be like, okay, well, if I'm really the only person or one of the few people that's, like, really reading this and sort of critiquing my own work, you know, how can I trust my own process before I'm in, like, sort of a workshop setting or something like that, you know?
Right. But then also the purpose of a workshop setting is to help you get other perspectives.
Is to do that. That's true. Yeah. So it can't, it can't be collaborative until a certain point, I guess.
Right.
I guess that's not true. Some people start from a collaborative place.
So what do you try to do to keep yourself from going down those rabbit holes, or to, you know, when you do feel that way, to kind of turn it around?
if I'm really great at that.
That's okay. I mean, it's an ongoing thing.
Right. I mean, and I think the thing is that, like, if you're really in that dark place, I don't think there is, like, a way out. I think it sort of has to ride its course. Not that I'm not condoning or, like, advocating just to, like, wallow in like, sadness or anything. But there is, you know, that sense of, like, I guess how much of it, okay, if you didn't have the dark place, then how would you, like, what sense of overcoming it would there be? It's sort of like you need both. And also, I feel like the dark place changes over time. Like, it's not a constant thing. For example, like, just out of school, the dark place, or in school, it's like, I feel like the teachers aren't understanding me, or, like, I'm being overlooked, and then, you know, and then it changes to, I didn't have the response I wanted out of the showcase, and then it changes to, I didn't get the audition that I wanted, and then, you know, I didn't get the fellowship I wanted, all that kind of stuff. And so if you can see that it's not a constant thing, then you know that it, if it changes, then you can move through it over time, you know?
Yeah, and that you're moving and growing in some way also, that it's because it's not the same.
Exactly.
I see.
Yeah, and if your perspective is shifting, I mean, I guess just in terms of, like, even goals and stuff are changing, and you know that you'll always kind of keep regenerating, you know? Like, there will always be another dark place, and there will always be, like, another moment of joy, you know, kind of thing. And also, like, I was in an office a few weeks ago, and was, like, applying for a health insurance thing, and there was a woman there, and in her cubicle, it's like, it was just covered in, like, butterflies, like, little stickers and, like, you know, figurines of them, like, all over her computer and desk, and I was like, oh, that's so cool, like, you know, I love the butterflies, and she was like, yeah, it helps you keep me happy. And it was, I thought it was such an interesting way that she said that, you know, it was like, it's not like I enjoy them or something, you know, it's like it keeps me happy, not like it makes me happy or something, you know. And I think, like, this is so relatable to do that, because I think there's a sense that we have to, like, both culturally and, you know, in other ways, that we have to sort of not, that feeling bad is actually, like, something that you have to avoid, you know?
Right.
But again, not to say, like, wallowing in something, but
right.
I think there is a fine line. And I guess more specifically what I try and, you know, stay inspired.
When did you kind of make the transition to focusing on writing? I know you're still an actor as well, but you've been mostly focusing on writing the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It happened, I don't know, it's funny, I didn't really write in school at all. I mean, I didn't have time, really. But it also wasn't really a desire of mine. Wasn't something that I thought I could really do. I did love creative writing as a kid. In, like, elementary school and everything, I would always, like, love, you know, the prompt where you could just make up a story. That was always, like, the best. And I would never want to finish them, you know. It was, like, one of those things where there's just a lot of, like, joy from that exercise. But then in high school and, like, acting, when I fully, you know, like, been like, okay, I'm an actor kind of thing. When we had, in my drama class, when we had to, like, write a scene, I enjoyed it, but I remember feeling so, like I was coming from such a cognitive place, you know, like really overthinking it. So I didn't enjoy it, and now it didn't, like, free me in the way that I was experiencing through the outlet of acting at the time. So so I didn't really pursue it. And then through school, I didn't at all. And then fourth year, I did towards the latter, the last few months of the year. Maybe it was like around out of the Greek in that experience, I started to write a screenplay, which was like completely abstract and like took place in the desert, and it just had so many huge factors of like larger than life kind of thing, you know, like something that would never be made kind of thing. But it was really exciting, and I enjoyed it. And then I didn't touch it again until, not that project, I put that to bed, but a year later, after spending the year auditioning after school, when I parted ways with my agency, and I guess it was maybe August of 2010, you know, I think I spent like a month being like, what am I going to do? And like looking for other avenues. And then all of a sudden, I just started to write again. And it started from a place of definitely like an outlet, because I wasn't going on as many auditions. Mm. So it was purely like creative energy needing an outlet kind of thing. And then as I got more into it, I think it became more self-serving in the sense of, oh, well, now I can, like, write this story or this screenplay or this play that I'm thinking of with, like, a character that I really want to play, you know? Right. And so it was very sort of, but I wasn't actually, like, technically as invested in the process of like learning the process of writing. It was very rash, and it came out in like very quick surges, and it was in like more like vignettes. And then I had someone read it, a friend of mine who wrote this awesome movie called Creed Moria. Her name's Lee Slimmer, and she since filmed it, but she read it, and she was like, great, now where's the arc? And really, it was like a kind way of saying, like, I don't know what to tell you about, you know, because it was all over the place. There was, like, it was purely vignettes, nothing led into anything else. It was very impulsive and erratic, and then something, I guess, changed from that experience, and then I really started to focus on, okay, who are these characters, and what is this story, and again, that was, like, the first play that I ever wrote. It's called Jack Hart Jump. I think you were involved in the reading of it, or you sat
there? Yes. Yes, I was.
And that was, I guess that was the first, like, loosely formed work. And I don't think it'll ever see the light of day.
We'll
and
see.
That's totally fine. It's like, it lives at that, like, first thing, you know? And in a weird way, I think, or not in a weird way, but, like, years fast forward now, several years, and I think I'm writing sort of, like, an iteration of that same type of story, but obviously with different characters and setting and everything that I've learned in terms of character development, all of that. But
is it still taking the
coming around full circle?
Is it still taking the form of a play or of a screenplay, or how has that worked?
So yeah, that's a big part of it. The medium switch. I think I first began writing screenplays.
Because I know you've always loved film in a way that, even though most of our acting work at Juilliard was theater-based, I felt like I always knew that you wanted to do film ultimately.
Yeah, that was a huge... absolutely.
And you were way more well-versed in film than I was.
Yeah, well, I was definitely, like, obsessive in terms of, like, I guess just rather than reading normal news, I would just read about, like, what was going on in the film world. So I don't know if that was, like, necessarily right, but it's just what I, what interested me. So, like, for that reason, I was definitely more engaged in that. And it, at first, it was a visual thing. And, you know, as a kid, film was the first, you know, sort of medium that I think that grabbed most kids and children just purely from spectacle. And,
well, and it's accessible, you know, too. Not everybody lives near a theater where they can see plays.
Exactly. Yeah, there's that. And also financially, too. You know, mm-hmm. It's so much easier to drive down the street and pay $12, although now it's like $16 to see a movie, you know, as opposed to, yeah, like a year, you know, and paying, you know, premium or semi-premium sort of prices. So for that reason, definitely, it was easier. And then I think I remember saying this in school at some point, but it was like when I was, the reason I got into acting was definitely like through watching movies and particularly like Spielberg type movies. In 1993, I saw Jurassic Park for the first time on the big screen, and I couldn't sit through the whole thing the first time. Like, when that dinosaur spits out the black stuff, we had to leave.
Oh, my gosh.
But I couldn't stop talking about it at home, and so we had to go back the week later.
It's a scary movie for a kid.
I know. It is scary, but it was like a challenge. It was like, I need to know what happens, you know.
Yeah.
But more than the cultural sort of phenomenon it was and how big it is, I think it was just such a great first example of like size and scope and like really being sort of gripped by a thing and also putting together the fact that the people in the movie weren't like living in the world of the movie, but were actually like real people. Yeah.
Hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, that's like, who wouldn't want to do that? You know, who wouldn't want to be trapped in the car and chased by a dinosaur and like play pretend? Everyone would. And then of course, you know, when you become more serious about being an actor, you move into theater. Because again, it's funny, even though film is more accessible in terms of viewing as a kid, theater is more accessible in terms of doing as a kid, for sure.
Right.
So then, you know, I became more invested in plays and learning about that. And at school, I think I always sort of felt kind of split. And I think it's an interesting thing with an institution like Juilliard because it's, you know, of course, I remember Michael Kahn saying in the very first, you know, the day I auditioned, like, this is a school for no theater, which it, of course, is. But also, fast forward 4 years, having gone through the school, it's just interesting that also a large part of what's celebrated and the alumni and everything involved is mostly through film.
Yeah, well, that I think that's the same reason, is that the people who see the films are many more than the number of people who can fit in a theater to see you in a play.
Yeah, that's true, but also from the side of, like, the school itself, I think, you know, which I'm not, like, I don't think that's wrong of the school or anything, but I think it's just interesting that, like, you know, when you go and you look up alumni or whatever, you know, from the school, it's all the recognizable sort of, like, you know, what you would think of in terms of, like, film.
Right. No, that's true.
Actors.
Movie stars.
And stuff. Yeah, it's just sort of publicized in that way. But anyway, that was a tangent, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So Michael Kahn was saying right about when you auditioned that it was a school for theater.
Theater, exactly. And then, of course, like with Richard Feldman and first year and and successively throughout the following years, like plays, approaching the play and all that. It's so, like, I still have that sheet of approaching the play and all the questions. And really, I think more than just learning to be a better actor, we were like taught to be like storytellers in the most wide sort of way imaginable, in terms of like really dissecting a play. And then, and that's when that became really interesting to me. And also, but I still had the whole, I still felt divided in terms of film and stuff. And then fast forward a few years, and out of school, I was writing screenplays at first. And then I only wrote my first play when I decided to adapt this work into a screenplay that I'd written into a stage play. And then now, fast forward even longer, 2 years, and I'm in a very interesting place right now that is kind of unexpected. But after moving out to Los Angeles, I've embraced playwriting in like a huge way.
Really?
I've almost exclusively been writing plays out here, which is completely bizarre if you think of like,
right,
you know,
how the industry out there is.
Yeah, just industry, you know, quote unquote, what the industry and the marketplace. But I think part of that is having some distance from New York. I'd only ever lived in New York. I think moving to the West Coast, sort of, I guess, when you're not in your the environment that's so familiar, you, I think, go back to sort of like, okay, what's inspiring me? What? How do I keep creating? And for me, the first impulse for getting back into playwriting was to go after something that seemed more accessible and something that I thought could be more, you know, something that I could, like, produce on my own and kind of thing.
Yeah, totally.
And then, but what's come of that is now, like, when I see film, I actually see how much, and especially film, like, lately, I think, just doesn't, like, just sort of skates over character development. And I know that film is never, like, a dialogue-driven medium. So it's not even like that, but it's more just like, I guess I'm seeing the way that I wish they were more related, the two mediums. Like, I almost wish films could be more like plays, you know? But I don't think there's any reason why we can't, like, film classics today that are being written today in the way that they did, you know, 40, 50 years ago when a great, you know, play or something was written, like, about the characters and they really stuck close to the source material. I think that could totally be, I think there's people that want that. And I don't think it's just people from a theatrical background. I think people that also just mostly see film recognize that there's less weight being put on character development and more weight being put on sort of like visual, like smoke and mirrors.
Right. Well, I'm sure that's all part of the financial side of it, right? Is that like, films are more and more expensive to produce. Less of them are getting produced. They want them all to be sellable, you know, on an international market. So it turns into a bunch of Tom Cruise movies and not character studies.
Right. Yeah. Of course. But then, and also, like, even commercial ones, I'm trying to give an example, but I feel like the commercial ones that are most successful, also, they do have that human element. Even in comedy, you know, I was recently talking to my sister about this, like, we saw Bridesmaids 2 years ago in theaters.
Oh my God, I love that movie.
I know, loved that movie, of course. It's hilarious, and one of the reasons it's so successful, though, I think, aside from being so funny and so well done, is the fact that it's about this friendship and the fact that this one person who tries to do, you know, this make everything right over and over again just fail each time, you know, worse than the last. And it's so human, and it's about their relationship together. And so I think, you know, aside from the gags and everything that work in it, it's of course the fact that it's also really relatable, and the comedy comes from something that's like very honest. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that transition from New York to LA and how you made that decision and how being in a new environment has influenced your writing?
Yeah. Yes, I drove out here in October of 2014, I guess. So that's a year and 9 months or so. And my sister was in Kentucky at the time. So I drove south first and visited her for like 2 weeks and then continued the journey. So I did take, you know, a good like 6 weeks to drive out. And I saved some money from waiting tables and stuff to, you know, allow myself this break of time before coming out here. And I think the impulse to come out here was largely from wanting a complete change of environment. I'd only ever grown up in New York, and I grew up in Manhattan on Long Island. And then I went to school in the city. And so it was all, you know, it was always, I guess it was just bound to sort of happen to eventually go to a different area. But the only other place I could think to go but still, like, pursue what I wanted to do, or, and I don't think this is true, but I think it's what I was thinking, or what you're sort of trained to think of as an actor, is that, okay, the other main city is Los Angeles, you know, so go there.
It's my only choice.
My only choice, right. Not that there's all these other amazing cities with thriving, you know, art scenes. But I did it, and I'm actually most nostalgic for that 6 weeks that I spent on the road where I didn't have, you know, where I was moving from A to B, and I didn't come here having an apartment or a job or anything. I just kind of went for it. So I think if I was really trying to do it in a very seamless, like, intelligent way, I probably would have set that stuff up first, but I really just wanted the adventure of it. And then once I've been here, I think I'm realizing that, you know, New York will always be home, but that Los Angeles and anywhere else I end up will always sort of have this element of adventure, in the sense that it's just unfamiliar still. And my writing, I think, has, I wouldn't say my output is more necessarily, because I was writing a lot before I left New York, but I will say that I definitely have a lot more isolation out here, just purely the fact that I live alone, and the whole car thing, and, you know, so I just spend most of my time writing, really. I mean, that wasn't different than New York, but I think, but the latest play that I'm writing does take place in Queens, which is the first time that I've
really
done that. Yeah.
How has that amount of solitude worked for you? Do you miss having a community, or is it kind of exciting to be on your own and exploring a new place without many people who know you and all of that? Even though I know you've lived there for almost 2 years now, so.
No, but it's funny because it still totally feels like that.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, the whole time thing is really weird, but to think that it's almost been 2 years since I left, because because of course the weather, and I don't have seasons here, you know, like,
right, to mark the, like, passage of time.
Right, and that's of course a whole other bizarre element, and I know that you're really used to seasons as well.
Yeah.
And so that's definitely one thing, but I don't know, I think I've always been kind of more isolated. I think
you're a little bit of a loner.
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I mean, in school, you can't really be one at all. So, you could be to a certain degree, but you're constantly around, like, the buzz and the energy of, like, your class and everything.
But I feel like you were always more plugged into, like, spending time one-on-one with people.
Yes, that is very true. One-on-one is definitely my language, for sure. Yeah, one-on-one is definitely more. And then I guess that's a natural sort of thing. And now, and it was this way in New York after school, too, though, but my main social outlet is work. Because I'm still a server out here at a restaurant, and it's really helpful, actually, to have, you know, those couple days on a week where you are around that many people, and not necessarily that the work is inspiring to me in my other work, because it's not, but it does allow me to have that social outlet with really, like, low stakes, and then to sort of just kind of depart, like a clean break, and then go and do your work when you're not there. And then I don't spend a lot of my off days being social, which I don't know how, you know, there's phases where it's necessary, I guess, and everyone has their own, you know, sort of gauge of you know, that barometer of what they need, and being around others and just doing, like, fun things that aren't related to work at all, you know, which, of course, is necessary. But yeah, there's also something really great about, like, the times where I felt some of the most joy is when I'm really just locked in and I have my head down and I just, like, go to the library every day on my off days. And, that's been some of the most, like, pivotal, you know, the pivotal time that I've had out here has actually been spent at the Writers Guild Library, which is a great resource for anyone listening who is out here. It's a library on 3rd and Fairfax, and you don't have to be a guild member. It's open to the public, and they have a lot of scripts, television and film, and a few, like, playwriting things as well, but aside from the resources, it's just, like, super quiet, and everyone in there, you know, in there, everyone's just going after the same thing and just wants to tell a great story, and, you know, it's really cool.
That's awesome.
How about yourself? Do you, I mean, of course, there's Frankie.
Like, socially, you mean?
Yeah, so socially, I mean, do you guys find yourself, like, going out with others on dates a lot, or is it, like, has it changed since school?
I feel like I can definitely we can both be homebodies, which is great in some ways. But I think I need to make an effort to make sure I see people or make sure I go to readings and plays and make myself be seen. It's really easy for me to isolate myself. And I've become, like, even just this week, I've been apartment sitting out here in the Rockaways for my friend, and Frankie is going to be here on the weekends. He couldn't be here during the week. And, like, so I've just been spending a lot of time alone. You know, I've gone into the city for work and back here and just alone. And it, I love being alone to a certain extent, but at a certain point, it's not good for me. So I'm becoming aware of, like, he's going to be staying in New Jersey for, like, 2 months this fall for a play and only coming back, you know, once a week. And I was like, I really need to make an effort while he's gone to see people, because it's not my natural state. I'm not, like, a super, super social person.
Right.
But I think it is healthy for me to make myself be around other people.
Yes.
Because otherwise I can get bogged down or feel like I'm not being productive or feel like I'm just disconnected from the world, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It can have the reverse, sort of.
But I do love being alone too. It's a weird balance. It's like I'm a social introvert.
Yes, I completely relate to that.
You know.
Actually.
Okay, we kind of touched on what you've been doing financially with serving, right? That's kind of been what you've been doing for a while, right?
That's what I've been doing. I mean, there was a phase where right out of school I was doing, like, every kind of job, like, you know, dog walking. I was like a house assistant for a few weeks. Like working at the movie theater. I was a projectionist for a while.
Oh, that's right. But as serving, like, how many days a week do you end up needing to work to pay your bills? Just like nitty gritty. Does it allow you enough time for writing, do you feel?
It does. It does. When I break it down, I work like four days a week, let's say.
Uh-huh.
And then I have, 3 days off. And that's like really vital for me.
That's great.
And also it helps working at night too. I have worked in restaurants though for a while now. Since 2011, I started as a host at this restaurant, Martini, in New York. And then that's where I got in as being a server after having hosted for a year. They were like, yeah, sure, we'll train you, And I was lucky because it was a really high volume place. And so for a first serving gig, it was very lucky. And you do make good money for the time that you're putting in there. I guess I don't know what else to compare it to, because I'm not as familiar with like the workforce, I think, than others in terms of like other standard jobs and what they pay. But I'd imagine it's really good for the amount of time you're putting in. But it can feel very taxing in terms of like having to be on in a way that can feel manufactured.
Right. Outgoing, on your feet all day.
Yeah, there's on the feet, which I think is fine too, because if I'm so solitary and stationary for like the other days, it's like, okay, cool, like I'm walking around, it's great. But I think you encounter, I think you just sort of have to be just kind of careful about where, I guess, still giving your all to a job, but not like your heart to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
not that anyone would really want to give their heart to like a serving job, but I mean like just in the little sense of like, if something gets you down in the moment at work, like don't take it home, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I've not perfected that. But
yeah.
It's just, yeah. So it's an ongoing thing for sure. And it is difficult. That's fine.
Can you tell me a little bit about how your family has reacted to you living a life as an artist?
Yeah, they're like 100% completely supportive. They always have been. I was really lucky to have them right next door in New York. They could like come to every show and...
Yeah.
They were always so, except I think like what was so challenging for them was like that first year when I was like, sorry, you can't see anything, but then after that in school, of course, they could come and support, and I think they fell in love with the whole process of being just the whole class, the whole notion of like going through this thing together. They still ask about, everyone in the class and how they're doing, and
they were so sweet to all of us.
Yeah, I think I'm really blessed for that, for sure. And my sister has been incredibly encouraging. I definitely had some moments, especially when I moved away, because I think you take it for granted when you're really close. But once I moved out west, where I would, just call and, after, like, I received a few rejections from fellowships in this past spring, it was sort of like, I took it especially rough during 1 week, and they definitely they're all about keeping on going, being resilient, and they just sort of remind me of that all the time. It's not even something really... that I think they have to try to do, and that's what's really stunning about it. It's very effortless,
And remind me, are any of them artistically inclined? I feel like your sister has done some artsy things in the past, right?
Yeah, she's an amazing piano player, and certainly a visual artist in many ways, and drawing and that sort of thing. And my mom went to FIT, and so she is an amazing artist as well, like fine art. And then she went into design, and but she's like extremely visual and photographic, and you know, design and fashion and that sort of element of it. So it is on that side. And my dad is certainly a writer, actually, in his own work as well, which, you know, he's done more like. He's made his living more in business than the stock market, but he certainly has always like had an incredible facility with language, and he's been writing a lot more of late as well. So it's definitely fair.
Do you feel like you guys can have a dialogue about that, or is it more of an unspoken thing
about writing?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have like lately more our discussion when we talk over the phone will go in that direction. So that's great, and it's also great that it's our interests are like varied enough where it's like I think there's always more to learn from him. He's like encyclopedic in a lot of ways. Just in terms of history and also like fiction and literature and, you know, like just things that I will never, even if I put in like all the time in the world, I wouldn't have like absorbed as much information as I feel like he has already. So so for that reason, yeah. And it has been fun to have him sort of like prompt me with questions about, you know, my own work and writing.
Is there something in the last couple of years that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about? Like a lesson you've learned, or doesn't have to be an obvious accomplishment, but something that you're just really proud of?
Yeah. So earlier, when I wrote that play last summer, I took off from work. I left the restaurant not knowing if I was going to go back, and I took a good 3 months off, so I saved, you know, money while I had been working there to cover the rent for those months. And it was really, like, I was just going to write this play and get it ready for this fellowship, and nothing else mattered. And for that, I think taking that risk was, like, the best decision I've made as an artist to date. Because although, of course, my money was, like, depleting, and it felt weird because I felt like I was claiming the profession of writing before I was actually being funded to do it, so I felt sort of like this almost guilt over it, you know? But I still did it, and now I think even though I didn't get into, like, the exact fellowships that I wanted with it or anything, I think just the, like keeping that sort of risk mechanism going, like I'll never be afraid to do that again down the road if I'm presented with that, the same, you know, liberty to do that. And also, I think mostly being less sort of ashamed of writing material with yourself in mind for certain roles. That's been a huge thing and a huge part of the process because I don't consider myself exclusively an actor or exclusively a playwright, and I think labels also are only necessary in a world where commerce is everything.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I don't think there's any other reason for those titles, but specifically, I feel like, okay, if you say you're an actor, and that was something I was listening to a previous episode, and you guys were talking about, like, eye rolls that you could get from people when you say, you know, and how, like, what's worse, saying you're an actor or a writer. And then I think, like, there's another eye roll that you can get when you're, like, when it's revealed that you're, like, an actor who writes, and also for themselves. Because that's, like, a triple eye roll of, like, okay, sure. you know, you're just, like, self-serving and all that. But, and it's weird. It's, like, we have this double standard, I think, where comedians and comic performers are much more sort of allowed to... or expected to write for themselves in a way where if you're writing a story that maybe has elements of comedy but is also, you know, a tragedy or something, that would just be sort of, I don't know, it's kind of strange to people, and I don't know why that is, but I think in the past 2 years since moving, grown more into the idea of, like, there's no reason why, like, if you think about it in terms of musicians, right, and there are certain musicians who only write music for themselves, it's most natural for them to do that, and for them to do another song or a cover of something would be strange, you know?
Yeah.
And they produce full albums of music, you know, with their own voice in mind, and think there's something really kind of great about that. I think it just means that you have to, like, work a lot harder to get to the, to make sure that, you know, you're doing it for the right reasons and that you're right. Really trying to tell a great story and to come back.
And that all the other characters have a distinct voice, I feel like. That, of course, the character you're writing for yourself is going to be really specific because you probably relate to it in some way or you have a desire to tell that story.
100%. And it's funny because actually the other character can maybe reveal itself more easily to you. Like this thing I'm writing right now, it's just a two-hander, a two-person play, and the brother and a sister. And the sister is like, I'm grasping, I think, a lot. I wouldn't say easier, but it's just like more clear who they are. Whereas when I arrive at the brother, keep coming back to, like, how they oppose each other. I'm sort of trying to create, like, a unity of opposites in what's going on between them. And with him, I feel like he can always be fluid. Like, I always have all these different directions that I could go in. But, so it's funny, because sometimes it can work in the opposite way.
Yeah.
Part of the process that I'm really excited for is when I can incorporate others, like, you know, other people that I know into the process, like once something workshops and that kind of thing. And
yeah.
The idea of, like, writing for friends is, like, really exciting too, because I know
that'd
how
be
much
the dream. That'd
not
be
only
amazing.
Like their talent and the things that, you know, they do so well, but also, like, we're in it together in terms of, like, not having jobs, you know. So to me, that would be, like, a perfect scenario to be able to, like, create something where you're just sort of working with like-minded people and friends and being able to create work for each other.
I mean, it's so smart, and it's something, like, I haven't really been drawn to writing, but I want to keep trying, and I wish that I were, because it's really, like, it's the way things are going right now. It's, you need to create work for yourself. So I think there's no shame in writing material that you see yourself acting into. I think that's smart, and
that's great. Thank you.
And I think it's more and more and more acceptable because that's the way the media is going. Because otherwise, it's
right.
Like all about names, and you have to already be famous to get cast in something.
Right.
And but if you can create a vehicle for yourself, then you have some power. Or like you were talking about before, like you have control, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I've experienced a lot of control.
Yeah.
Just purely through the process of, like, of the writing part of it, you know. But also, and it's funny, you know how they say that writers write the same story over and over again?
Uh-huh.
But that they just sort of, like, you know, change, of course, the characters and, like, events and stuff. But they essentially boil down, they have, like, one story to tell. Like, I guess the theory, well, I feel that it's all, you could say the same exact thing for actors. I feel like actors are born with one story to tell. And I mean, take this with a grain of salt, but I feel like actors are born with one story to tell, and but to tell it over and over again in so many different ways. And when they read a play or a movie, and they're going to audition, and they're like, oh my God, like, this part is everything. This is me, you know, and this is the perfect time in my life to do this. Like, it's done, you know? That really, I think what they're saying is oh, that, I think they're saying the same thing that a writer is when they're writing their own work. It's sort of like it finds you kind of thing. And I think even if actors don't feel an impulse to write per se, that they definitely have that singular story in them. And I think anything they can do in terms of like world building, like, I don't know, just like music or that inspires them, like a soundtrack to a story that they imagine, like all that kind of stuff can only like sort of help that come out, essentially.
Yeah, it's true that each actor is kind of drawn to their same pocket of stories or their strong suit.
Yeah, and I don't think the actor is any weak because of it. And I think also that they could be technically a character actor and still,
yeah,
be drawn to a certain type of, you know, it's not necessarily like the way they stretch. It's more like, I don't know, there's like a spirit to it, you know, almost like a spiritual element to the work.
Are there any concrete things that you turn to again and again if you're having a day where you just feel uninspired or that you are going to the dark place and you need to get out of it? Like, is there a book that you reread or an album that you listen to or a place that you go?
I definitely try to immerse myself in stories of other artists who have, you know, gone before you kind of thing. And not just actors, almost actually usually not actors, because for whatever reason I find like bios and stories on actors like slightly manufactured. I don't know why, but that might just be like of late kind of thing. But
no, I think sometimes seeing art that isn't your field or reading about artists that aren't in your field, it gives you a little bit of distance to be inspired.
It does, and like in going to this world building thing we're talking about, like just stories, like for example, you were talking about Disneyland before. Walt Disney has a really, you know, fascinating story, and I haven't read it yet, but I just bought this Time magazine with him on the cover, and the whole story is like, I guess, snippets of like all these Time articles with him through time. You know, apparently just little things, like just reminders, like I just read a section of it that was saying that Bambi was a huge flop when it came out. And I was like, what? You know, that's not something that you imagine. You see these, you know, icons, and it doesn't even have to be an icon. It could be any artist, and you tend to see them for their, like, legend status, but not for, like, all of the failure, you know, quote-unquote failure.
Or the journey.
The journey. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, that's why I like doing these interviews, is because I know every person I'm talking to is great, but I want to hear about what they're doing right now, not in 50 years, because that's what's interesting to me.
That's such a great way of, what they're doing now. I mean, that's so true.
Not looking back on it from their fifth Oscar win, but what it is when they're slogging through the mud. You know?
Yeah, and you're actually, I mean, because of it, you're getting a lot more honesty, I think, than you would, you know, looking back from your success on what came before. You know, there's no other way but to be honest when you're kind of in it, you know? So that's why I'm really appreciative for what you're doing. Well, yeah, there's so many stories like that. I just read Wuthering Heights for the first time.
Oh, really?
And Emily Brontë is one of those people where I was like, are you serious? Like, I don't quote me, but I think she passed when she was 29 or 30, and she wrote the book the year before.
Oh my gosh.
And it was her only novel, and it's like, and it wasn't a success at all, and it's sort of like, you know, by any monetary means, I mean. And Jane Eyre, written by her sister, was like far more considered superior to it. And then, you know, fast forward time, and I'm so fascinated by like what the impulse was for them to, because she obviously had to get that story up, you know, and like her whole life was like almost culminating into that story. It was like, it's such a like powerful amount of energy.
Right now, from where you are right now in your journey, like, how do you define success as compared to, like, we were talking about with the dark side, like, what other people define success as, and,
Right.
How do you kind of picture that right now and in a long-term view, or how is that different from what it started out being when you left school? Because I know my view has changed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, very simply, and this isn't the full answer, but just very simply, one thing that has remained is that I would love to make a living doing what I'd like to do.
Yeah.
Totally. And I think we can all say that without a shadow of a doubt. So that's, of course, success in a primary basic bubble. Like, you know, being able to take care of your needs and the ones that you love that are closest to you, you know, monetarily by doing what you love. Who doesn't want that, you know? But also, I don't know, it's so funny. Like, when you think about, and it goes back to rejection. Because when you get the rejection for things and you're really bummed out, you know, you fast forward a few weeks and it's funny, you look back and you think, that's not my idea. That wasn't like the be-all, end-all idea of my success, you know?
Right.
So, like, perspective is constantly shifting, I think, in terms of what you...
Well, in the moment, any defeat can seem like the be-all, end-all.
The be-all, end-all. That is very true. I think success is just going to be... it's going to be, I guess, continuing to merge both outlets of my writing and acting, however I can do that.
Awesome.
Because I think before I was primarily actor, now I think I'm considered primarily writer, but I really look forward to the intersection of those in the future, and whatever that will be success.
Are there any recommendations that you want to give to things that you've seen or read lately, or...
There is, yes. And actually a lot of people who are listening to this have probably read it already. But in the newest publication of the Glass Menagerie, there's an essay written by Tennessee Williams at the end of it. And it's called The Catastrophe of Success. Did you read that?
No.
Oh my God, it's so brilliant. There's it was published in the New York Times like about 2 years after the Glass Menagerie was first produced in Chicago, and he talks about, and it's so brilliant for where we all are and listening to this podcast, because he talks about how he was launched from, you know, obscurity to suddenly being, like, the center of New York theater in, you know, in such a short period of time with the Glass Menagerie, and how he was living in a hotel and put up in a hotel for a while, and he said that he got really depressed, and he stopped being able to accept, like, compliments from people, and whenever they were like, I loved your play, he would just, like, turn away from them because he, like, didn't know how to react to that for a while. Which, of course, like, reading this, you're like, really? You know? You're like, that sounds, you know, really hard. But he does it in such an eloquent way, and he comes back around to saying, the main gist of it is that the artist, like, the plight of the artist is to be in a state of struggle. Or I shouldn't say the plight, the he's saying that work comes out of a place of struggle, and that being suddenly put in this hotel and everything is actually, it was like he was grasping at air, you know, where before he had climbed up these rocks, like, you know, constantly trying to get ahead, and then suddenly he got to the top and there was nothing left, and then he realized that being, still having that energy but not having it, like, push him anywhere was actually taking away who he was as an artist and what was essential for him to keep creating art. And long story short, he ended up having an eye operation. And he said the time behind the gauze that he spent was, like, pivotal, because he actually couldn't see the world and he could only rely on, like, hearing people. And when friends came to the hospital, he said he started to really hear their words for what they were. And then he moved out of the hotel and he moved to Mexico for a few weeks and wrote The Poker Night, which became Streetcar Named Desire, or part of it.
Huh.
So, anyway, but he has, here, wait, I have it in front of me. If you'll allow me, I will read a tiny little three-sentence passage.
Do it.
He says, "It is only in his work that an artist can find reality and satisfaction, for the actual world is less intense than the world of his invention, and consequently his life, without recourse to violent disorder, does not seem very substantial. The right condition for him is that in which his work is not only convenient, but unavoidable." That's really beautiful. It's extreme, but I think it's on point.
All right. Well, I gotta find that whole introduction. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. It's just like 5 pages, and it's in the back of the Glass Menagerie that has the black cover with the abstract white pencil drawing.
Sean, you are wonderful, and I'm really thankful that you're my friend and that you're willing to open up to us for the podcast. Thank you.
Oh, likewise, yeah. It's like a great privilege to be asked to do this, and I'm really grateful to be a part of this and a part of your creation. So thank you for that, and thank you for trusting that I had something that I was willing to communicate.
I love you.
I love you too.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.